As we start the new year, there's a lot to look at when we talk about our expectations for 2019, and that includes the state of our economy and what may lie ahead. Hawaii State Economist thinks we can expect slower growth this year, and HPR's News Director Bill Dorman is here with some thoughts about what to watch for with various indicators along the way. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Aloha, Catherine. You know, quite a lot to look at with different perspectives in the economy, and when you hear about economic expectations, a lot of times you get those headline numbers about growth rates, the overall economy, gross domestic product. And that's an important part of the picture for sure. But there's a lot more. The GDP figures are sort of a view from 10,000 feet, but then there's also the view from the ground. You can learn a lot from some of those threads that actually go into the statistics that make up the economy and also are publicly available information, which is important for listeners to keep an eye on. But let's start with that big picture. National economy expected to slow this year. So is Hawaii's. We're still looking at growth, not recession, but slower growth. And that's against the background of what's been a pretty healthy economic picture, both here in the United States broadly, since coming out of that recession in 2008-2009. Modest growth, but still steady. And as for Hawaii, State Economist Eugene Chien briefed lawmakers yesterday about those macro expectations for this year. And our producer, Ryan Finnerty, went to that session. Chien says we can expect growth of just over 1% this year. That's slower than the national economy. It's in line with other estimates we've heard from the end of last year, expectations that have been scaled back when it comes to Hawaii's economy, even from several months ago. But Chien also gave an important reminder that Hawaii doesn't move in lockstep with the national economy. And in the past, sometimes that has been a crucial difference.
In 10 years, between 1991 and 2001, we actually had a decrease in GDP by about 0.1% between those 10 years, while the U.S. economy was booming at 3.6%. Those 10 years for the U.S. is the growth, the booming of the IT industry. But Hawaii was a tourism-dominated industry, and during those 10 years, our tourism industry has some changes because the decrease from Japanese visitors used to be 33%, one-third of the total visitors, and it decreased to about from 2.2 million to 1.5 million. And now the Japanese visitors accounted only about 16% of the total visitors.
You know, people forget that sometimes. The Japanese used to be a third of all of the visitor arrivals. And also, Hawaii lost out on the high-tech boom of the 90s. But those visitor arrivals, that's such a key factor. We always track that and the numbers on arrivals. And by those numbers, 2018 is going to track to be another record year. The headline spending number will be, but as our friend Paul Brubaker always points out, in relative terms, those are not really records because they don't account for inflation. The true peak of value was back around the peak of Japanese tourism, which is 1989, but the arrival numbers are records. There are other indicators, though, not to just obsess on the visitor arrivals numbers. Not all of them make headlines. Car sales, for one thing, in any economy, looking at what happens with that. In Hawaii, new vehicle registrations likely to close 2018 with their worst showing in 3 years, down about 5.5% through the first three quarters. Bankruptcy filings are at a three-year high. Timeshare visitors flat or down through the first three quarters. A lot of the baseline figures about Hawaii's economy remain positive. Unemployment has risen a bit, but it's still low. Visitor numbers, again, still pretty strong, and that is one of the most significant contributors to the economy overall.
Now, what about from the business sector? What are the companies saying?
So it's interesting. Companies, and again, this is good for folks to keep an eye on. It's part of those larger forecasts, but more of a micro view of conditions on the ground. Every publicly held company needs to alert investors about conditions that can have an impact on its earnings. That can extend to a broader view about a particular industry and sometimes about the economy itself, expectations and assumptions that companies use as part of their planning. So, for example, if you look in Matson's latest earnings reports, its profits were up 22%. And you might look at that and say, wow, business was great. But they said in their report, no, no, it's not because of revenue increase due to business conditions. It's because of the tax cuts, the federal tax cuts.
Thank you, President Trump.
Exactly. And one of the issues with that, it's like a sugar buzz. It's going to wear off. It's a boom one-time hit, but it's not something that is a returning investment in that sense. Matson, though, in its same earnings report, did say its view of the Hawaii economy remains strong, low unemployment, what it calls healthy tourism activity. But then you have, on the other hand, and, you know, Harry Truman said he wanted a one-handed economist, so he couldn't say on the other hand, because economists always say on the other hand. But on the other hand, Hawaiian Airlines just cut its earnings outlook last month on slowing growth for visitor growth from North America to Hawaii. And you see that cautionary, that uncertainty creeping into more earnings reports as there's uncertainty, everything from trade policy to government shutdown.
Now, were there any other insights that Eugene shared with us?
Little bit about overview of components of Hawaii's GDP, growth industries, real estate, tourism, healthcare. Real estate includes value of homes, a big number, but it doesn't generate a lot of employment. Biggest contributors to employment in the state, tourism number one, healthcare number two, construction number three. Two of those are expected to slow, tourism and construction. Healthcare, interestingly, will grow even during a recessionary period.
Now, because we sort of ended the year last year with a big gulp because we saw what the stock market did, a big hiccup.
Yes, yeah. So, and you have this remarkable period of volatility. You know, right now, just Lakshmi Singh telling us, oh, the Dow's up 746 today, up more than 3%. And after big decline yesterday, you have a lot of this uncertainty. The jobs numbers out today, 312,000 jobs created in December, upward revisions of past payrolls for the previous 2 months. Those are strong figures. That's strong news. A lot of this in terms of how it's going to impact, say, visitor arrivals in Hawaii, is it plays into the fragility of consumer confidence. And that's part of the secret sauce of any economy, of how are people feeling about that? Are they feeling wealthy, good enough about their prospects and their current situation and their immediate future to be able to splash out some money to travel to Hawaii? Also, what is the market for Hawaii? Is that increasingly higher end folks who are maybe less impacted by fluctuations on something like that? You know, one interesting thing in terms of Japan, for instance, Japan has been in recessionary periods in the recent past where travel to Hawaii has not dropped off as significantly as some had thought. So there are a lot of factors that go into economic outlooks. So I would say for listeners, yes, check the headlines, but also look for some of these other threads that go into the composition of the economy. It's really pretty fascinating.
Right, and it is all connected, right? We've got tariffs and construction down. We need
sure
all the construction materials, you know, so Matson gets all those container loads of supplies in. So, yeah.
The interconnections and the interlocking parts of the economy. Yeah.
All right, Bill, thank you.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is our news director. He joined us this morning with a look ahead at Hawaii's economic health going forward into 2019.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Chaminade University, Inter Island Solar Supply, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
It's a new year, and for homeowners, that means updated property tax assessments. As 2018 was wrapping up, the City and County of Honolulu was sending out updated property value assessments to homes across Oahu. Ilarka Ewan, a realtor with Coldwell Banker Pacific Properties, reached out to us about her big increase.
When I received my real property notice of assessment, I was pretty astonished to see the value. I am a realtor, so I do follow values in my neighborhood. I live in a condominium community with lots of similar floor plans. There's enough sales in here that I felt I could get a good read on what sales there had been, so I could see what they were basing this figure on. The valuation was up more than 10%. I went to the Multiple Listing Service database and did a search. There was nothing I could find that substantiated that value. However, I do have to say that Royce Talbot at the city tax office was super helpful and very erudite. I appreciated what he had to say. He explained to me, first of all, that they don't use the most recent 6 months data, which is what comes up on the Multiple Listing Service database. They use for a condominium, generally the first 6 months of the year. For single family dwellings, they can go back further. When I went to search the first 6 months of the year, indeed there was one sale at the price that my place is now assessed at. And then in reading the newspaper the next day, I saw that the state, or the city rather, has the ability to a 10% margin of error. And given that, it would appear that I have nothing to contest, but I would say this should be a banner year for the city in terms of tax revenue. It's a bit shocking because the market has softened a little bit, and to see these values brought in as we're watching the prices soften, but our tax valuations go way up, that contrast is a little hard to take.
That was Makakila resident Ilarka Ewan. Now, setting property evaluations is the job of Stephen Takara, head of the City and County's Real Property Assessment Office. He spoke with Hawaii Public Radio's Ryan Finnerty about how the process works.
So we sent out notices of assessments, not the tax bill. So just to clarify, tax bills go out in July and January. So that was just your assessment notice. Basically, what that is your notice to inform the property owner taxpayer of what they're going to be taxed upon. So what it consists of is obviously the property description, the location, the tax map key, number or parcel ID, the identifier, as well as the site address that we have on record, the owners we have on record. I guess more importantly is the assessed valuation, which is what you're going to be paying taxes upon, along with the classification, which indicates the tax rate that you would pay in conjunction with your valuation. Also indicated on the assessment notice is any tax relief that the property owner has been granted or has been entitled to. For instance, a home exemption, if the property owner resides on the property, they can get a homeowner's exemption, which is $80,000 off of their assessed value to reduce their net taxable to, you know, minus the $80,000 if they're age 64 and below. If you're age 65 or higher or greater, you get a $120,000 exemption off of your assessed value. There's other exemptions involved. There's like 20-something exemptions, but that's basically the principle of it. So your classification, so let's say your property is residential, you would pay a residential tax rate. Commercial, you pay a commercial tax rate, industrial, hotel, resort, agriculture, and so forth. Those tax rates are established by council in June, just prior to the tax year. So the assessments that went out in Saturday, that's for tax year coming up July 1st, 2019 to June 30th, 2020. So council sets the tax rates typically in June of 2019.
So you're actually working a year ahead.
Correct. Okay. So what happened, or what initiated, once we sent it, the notices out December 15th, that has a window, a 30-day window for people to contest or challenge our assessment. So if they disagree with our value, they can appeal the value to the Board of Review and dispute the value as well as the classification. So if you feel your property should be in residential and not commercial or industrial or hotel, you can dispute the classification as well, including any exemptions or dedications that you feel you're entitled to. So anything on the assessment notice that you disagree with, you can appeal to the Board of Review. That's comprised of independent citizens of Honolulu, appointed by the mayor, but adopted or approved by City Council. So it's a $50 deposit to complete your appeal, part of the appeal process. So, and that'll be heard by the board. And then, you know, if the board, I guess, sides with the appellant or the taxpayer that we're wrong, then adjustments will be made and you get your $50 back.
Stephen, so probably the thing people are most concerned with when they get that assessment is the value of the property, because that's what drives how much they're going to have to pay in tax. How does the city and county assess the value of all these different properties that are on Oahu?
Yeah, okay. So by ordinance, we're to follow two approaches to value. One is the cost approach, and the other one is market sales or market comparison approach. So the market approach is we're comparing market sales of comparable properties, you know, residential properties that sold kind of within the same neighborhood, same size lot, same size, you know, improvements and so forth, similar to commercial properties, industrial, hotel, and so forth. So we use basically comparable sales. Then we also use the cost approach. Basically, it's sales, and then we do what we call land abstraction. We extract out the improvements to get a land value. And if we have vacant land sales, we have a land value, you know, per square foot or per acre. And then we have cost factors to calculate how much it would be to build the property. So replacement costs new, then we minus out any depreciation. So if the building is or the improvements are 10 years old, we'll take off some percentage of depreciation that we feel the property or the improvement has endured over the past 10 years or 30 or 40 or 50 years versus, you know, a brand new home hasn't incurred much depreciation or wear and tear or deferred maintenance.
And so is there a person, a city employee, who's looking at every individual property out there, or how does that work?
Yeah, so we have about 300,000, or we sent out about 295 taxable properties. So we sent out about 295,000 assessment notices. So it's difficult to do. I think we have about 42, 43 appraisers the last time I counted. The appraisers are responsible to visit each property. I don't know what that parcel count is, you know, per person, but we try to make an effort to visit and conduct on-site inspections of each property. It's difficult to do, but, you know, the ones on appeal, properties that have permits, or we get calls about the property owner is saying that there's a discrepancy in property records. You know, we tend to put those higher up on the priority to conduct on-site visits.
So one thing that I'm thinking about, Stephen, is a view of some kind might increase the value of a property, but then the loss of that view, either from construction or some other reason, might decrease the value of the property. How does something like that, that's pretty subjective, how does that factor into the calculation?
Yeah, correct. Great question. So it's all market-driven or reflective of the market. So let's say we have a property that is a beautiful view, unobstructed view of Ala Moana or Waikiki. That property sells for $1.5 million with that view. Then next year, a building goes up or something blocks the view. So the appeal or the desirability of that unit may be diminished. So let's say that person says, oh, I got to get out of this thing. My view is gone. The market may not reflect that 1.5 that he bought it at because of a diminished view. So when that person sells it, you know, being everything being equal, let's say the property sells for 1.4 because of the loss of view, then that adjustment is 100,000. Okay, so I guess I was trying to describe, you know, how something like that would be reflective of the market. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And so would you say if for people who have seen an increase in their property tax liability, on this assessment. Is that primarily due to market forces, just the rising property values, assuming they haven't made any kind of improvement to the home?
Correct. Yeah. So as I was trying to describe the market approach, so if comparable sales increase in value, or, you know, your neighbor or a similar type property or in a condo, the same floor in the same project start selling for more, which is very similar to yours, then the value of your property probably has gone up as well. And then conversely, in a down market as well, right? So if the property next to you sells for less, you know, than what it was assessed at, then, you know, we would like to think that we would recognize that in the market and then adjust accordingly.
So you mentioned earlier there's about 295,000 properties that get taxed every year. How long does it take your department to go out and do the assessments on all of that? I know you said you were working a year ahead. How long does it take to actually process the whole island?
Yeah, so we do that annually. So that's what we, you know, our division has about 100 employees and about 42, 43 appraisers. So the appraisers are responsible for the upkeep and the maintenance of property records. So make sure that, you know, the improvements still exist, or if there was an addition or demolition of the property improvements, then we would record that as well. So so if there's a building permit with a large addition or renovation, you know, we would go out and inspect and basically maintain that record or update that record of any changes to the property throughout the year. One of the responsibilities of the appraisers is to maintain accurate records. So that's why I push the public to look at their records on our website, realpropertyhonolulu.com. And if what we have on record is inaccurate or there's a discrepancy, please call our office. There's a discrepancy or inaccuracy, then your assessment is inaccurate. So that's why we encourage people to inform us of any discrepancies, and then the appraiser will go out and confirm and update the records accordingly.
And anyone out there has until January 15th to submit an appeal for something that they don't feel is accurate?
Correct. Yeah. So to kind of finish my thought on what we do annually, so that's one part, right? So we got to get correct data that we're assessing. Then we look at sales. So we call, you know, we try to verify this arm's length transactions. So fair market value sales are used to calculate the fair market value of the comparables or the 295,000 taxable properties.
That was Stephen DeCara, administrator of the City and Counties of Honolulu's Real Property Assessment Division. And a reminder again, you only have until January 15th to file an appeal. If you have not gotten your assessments, you should contact the city. We will post a link with phone numbers on hawaiipublicradio.org. Honolulu Civil Beat takes us to Washington, where we get our reality check with reporter Nick Ruby. He kicks off a two-part series on Mr. Case Goes to Washington. Morning.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so interesting story you have. He had a big first day, didn't he?
Yeah, well, the new Congress was sworn in yesterday, and there was a lot of excitement, particularly in the House, where Democrats took control for the first time in a while. And in fact, it was a historic day for the House. In the November elections, we saw what many people are calling a blue wave, in which Democrats took 41 new seats, which of course gave them the gavel, and they elected Nancy Pelosi as Speaker. A few other things to note about this particular group of freshmen is that with all of the incoming freshmen, we have a record number of women in the Congress, which includes two Muslim women for the first time and two Native American women for the first time. The Congress as a whole is the most diverse, racially diverse in U.S. history. And we also saw the youngest woman ever elected to Congress in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Now, amidst all this is Hawaii Congressman Ed Case, a white guy from Hawaii who's been there before and is considered a freshman, despite the fact that he's been around before. Of course, he served from 2002 to 2007 as a representative representing Hawaii's 2nd District. Now, typically, a first day is boring on the Hill. Maybe not boring. It's more ceremonial, I guess. And this time around, it wasn't. That's because we're still in the midst of a partial government shutdown. So one of the first things that the Democrats in the House did was vote to end the shutdown, which, of course, President Donald Trump and the Republicans in the Senate do not seem likely to help end themselves.
Well, you know, I remember covering Ed Case's win election night the first time he went off to the nation's capital. And so it's interesting seeing him come back. So clarification again. So he really doesn't get any credit for the time that he was in Washington. So he's still considered a newbie. Is that right?
He is still considered a freshman. But what's interesting is his seniority does carry over in certain aspects of governing. One, curiously enough, is selection of his office space. He was able to select offices ahead of the rest of the freshman class because he'd been there before, which he seemed pretty excited about when I talked to him.
Gotcha. Okay. Interesting. And then what can you tell us about your story tomorrow?
Yeah, well, we actually published it on our website today. And it's part of what will be an occasional series for Civil Beat, in which I'm going to speak with Congressman Case from time to time and try to get an insider view into what's actually happening on the Hill and sort of how he's operating there within this historic Congress as it grapples with not only governing or trying to govern in a partisan environment that we see today, but also one in which Donald Trump is president, and you know, as they try to provide oversight and be at least some sort of check on the power coming out of the executive branch.
Yeah, well, a very interesting time to be in Washington, D.C., and we're glad you're there covering it.
It is very fun, and thank you so much for having me on today.
Okay, well, we'll be checking back with you from time to time because lots of action there. Thanks so much.
All right, that sounds good. Thanks, Catherine.
Okay. That was reporter Nick Ruby with today's reality check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
We're looking for a pledge and listener experience producer. This dynamic team player will have the responsibility of producing our semi-annual fund drives and outreach activities. If you have a background in events coordination or broadcast production with experience managing cross-functioning teams, check out the employment opportunities page on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Island Insurance, and Sacred Hearts Academy.
This week, Hawaii's Death with Dignity Law went into effect. The law allows terminally ill patients to request a lethal prescription to voluntarily end their lives. Including Hawaii, there are now 5 states, plus the District of Columbia, that allow medical aid in dying. John Radcliffe became the first patient in Hawaii to request the lethal prescription. Diagnosed with terminal cancer, he's outlived his 6-month prognosis. He starts his 72nd round of chemotherapy next week. The nonprofit group Compassionate Choices advocates for improved access to medical aid in dying. Kate West is the National Director of Policy and Programming for Compassionate Choices. She had this to say as Hawaii's law went into effect. I'm pleased to report that Hawaii is ahead of most other states at this stage of the law's implementation. Already, numerous medical provider education events have occurred, and more are planned for doctors and other providers. And most healthcare systems and facilities are adopting policies of engaged neutrality that honors patient end-of-life decision-making. We encourage residents, no matter which island they reside on, to have conversations with their doctors now about whether their doctor would support them if they were to become terminally ill and request medical aid in dying. We know from experience it is the only way that residents can ensure that they will get the care they want at the end of life. Now, Dr. David Grube is a retired family physician and the National Medical Director for Compassionate Choices. He spent his career practicing in Oregon, which was the first state in the nation to allow medical aid in dying. He was in Hawaii leading up to the legalization of this law to help educate local healthcare professionals about the new law. And he spoke with Hawaii Public Radio's Ryan Finnerty.
So I practice in a very small town in Oregon, and I've practiced there since 1977. The law in Oregon passed in 1996, but actually took effect in 1997. It wasn't until about 1999 that a first patient who was dying came to me requesting support and help and wanted to consider using the Death with Dignity law. I had no experience in that, although I've taken care of many people that were dying and have been involved in hospice since 1980. This was new to me, so I needed to reach out, and I reached out to a medical director of a hospice, Dr. Cleaver, and he and I met and talked, and he taught me how to respond to the request, to ask questions of the patient about what they really need, what they really want, to make sure that their family knows about their request, and to begin to understand all the complexities and very difficult things that they're going through. So that process happened, and then since that time, over the years, once perhaps or twice a year, a patient might want to talk about this.
And this is something that a lot of doctors have a big ethical problem with, so I imagine it's not really something that's covered in most medical schools, especially since it's not legal in every state. Are young doctors getting experience with how to handle these type of cases?
So I think it goes even deeper than that. I think historically, and this may shock you or may not, but historically doctors haven't been taught much about dying, the dying process, about how to talk about death, end-of-life experiences. So actually nationally, in all states, in all medical schools, this has become a kind of a focus. People are living longer, and it's very complicated to die in America. It doesn't... especially if you're in a health system and you're in the hospital with our wonderful new technologies. So historically, right, there's been no education. However, now in Oregon, both medical schools we have in Oregon teach end-of-life classes, including Death with Dignity, and schools I know in California, Washington, and Colorado teach end-of-life courses that include medical aid in dying, or as you would have in Hawaii, the Hear Our Choice Act.
Well, there are five states across the country, including Hawaii and then also the District of Columbia, that have some type of Death with Dignity law. Are they fairly uniform, or do they vary from state to state?
Very, very uniform. The Oregon law, which was, as I said, is 21 years old, hasn't been changed a word in all that time. So it's effective and works well. So all the other states modeled their law on the Oregon law. Hawaii's new act is almost the same, a few little differences here and there, but pretty much the same.
And it takes effect January 1st. So that's when patients are eligible to request this type of service. What types of issues have you encountered over your professional career when it comes to actually carrying out these types of requests?
Well, first of all, we need to look at each individual case and make sure that we understand what the patient's values and priorities are, and whether other kinds of things are bothering them, and is this appropriate to even be talking about. But if you go through all that, and particularly if you listen, sit down and listen, each case, each person has a backstory that is different, and we need to address those. I try to make sure every person is involved in hospice, and has a hospice nurse and personnel to help them. So I think that's very, very important. And then address their cultural and religious issues, make sure that we understand, those aren't going to be a conflict for them. And, of course, personally, and I think you asked this question and I didn't answer it, we have to look at ourselves and understand if this is aligns with our professional integrity.
Well, and on that line, many doctors do consider this at odds with the Hippocratic Oath that all physicians take. How have you squared those somewhat conflicting ideas in your professional career?
That's a great question. So if you really look at it, no doctor takes the Hippocratic Oath and hasn't for almost 20 years. It's not used in any medical schools anymore. There are new oaths, the Physician's Oath, the Geneva Ethical Code, etc. So that everyone always brings that up, oh, the Hippocratic Oath, but it doesn't really exist. It's not a thing. So the prime issues that you think about, I think, in this regard are patient autonomy. In other words, an intelligent adult has the right to choose to have any treatment or not have that treatment. And beneficence, do good things for people, make sure to help them. Primum non nocere, which means don't do harm, do no harm. That's also called non-maleficence. And historically, I think we doctors and healthcare professionals have been the ones that have defined harm. But I think we're learning to understand that actually the patient should be the one that defines harm. And if they feel that the treatments they're going through are onerous and their suffering is terrible, that may be harmful. So so I think medical aid in dying aligns with all those things, particularly patient autonomy, beneficence, and non-maleficence.
And now that this procedure is legal in several states, and it has been for a few decades now, if we go back to Oregon's enacting of it, have there been any legal challenges over a particular patient trying to either wanting this and their family member not wanting them to do it, or perhaps vice versa, where family members are pushing a patient to get this done and maybe the patient is hesitant?
So nothing in the latter case, of course, because there's protections in our act in Oregon and in your act that this is volitional. There's voluntariness on the part of the patient. All patients are screened about this. They're also, if they're in hospice, they have a bath aide, a nurse, a chaplain, a social worker who will monitor and watch that there's not coercion. In regard to legal action, there have been individual legal actions here and there, none of which have ever come to fruition. There's never been any doctors who've been disciplined. There's been never ever any evidence of abuse or coercion that's ever been recognized. The one legal case that actually kind of happened, it was in California a few months ago, where a group asked that it not be legal. It was the judge declared it to be held on hold for a few months until it went to appeal. Now it's in appeal, so it's legal again in California, and that case is still to be determined. But really nothing.
What types of protections exist to make sure that there is no unethical or even illegal behavior going on?
Very, very good question. So first of all, it involves two different doctors. So your own doctor has to determine that you understand what you're requesting, that you are about to die. It's called a terminal illness. That you have volition, and that you can self-ingest. In other words, you have to take the medicine yourself. The doctor doesn't give it to you. Then that you have to go to a second doctor who does the same thing, has to determine all those things. In Hawaii, you have to go to a third provider, and that gets a mental health assessment. We don't have that in other states, but Hawaii has that third protection, if you will, or maybe even becomes a barrier, because these are very, very sick people. And for them to get in to three different providers, and the first provider, you have to get in twice to see them, four different visits are protections. A waiting period in Hawaii, it'll be 20 days. You have to wait 20 days between the time that you first asked and the time that medication could be given to you. And then also written protection, so that you actually have to write out that this is what you want to do and has to be witnessed and signed by two different individuals. So quite a number of protections.
So it sounds like a pretty lengthy process.
It can be very lengthy. And indeed, a number of people request this and don't live to get through to a time where they can determine the last chapter of their story.
a lot of people may better know the issue of death with dignity as medically assisted suicide, and there's been a movement to rebrand that towards death with dignity. Do you think there's a difference between those two terms fundamentally?
Fundamentally, complete difference. I think as a clinician, as a doctor who's taken care of patients for 40 years, I can recognize it entirely differently. A suicidal patient generally has some active mental illness. They may have PTSD, they may have drug addiction, they may have a major depressive disorder. And all people who use Aid in Dying cannot have an active mental illness. They're ruled out. If they have major depressive disorder, they aren't eligible for medical aid in dying. A suicidal patient acts alone and acts too often in a violent way, with a result that's horrible for everyone. Whereas an aid in dying patient acts with their family, they're together with their loved ones, with their music, with their candles, in a very, almost one could say, spiritual situation. And I think then finally and very importantly is a total difference in the grief reaction of the family, the loved ones, and the doctor after both instances. In a suicidal case, we all wonder what could we have done to have kept this person from having this terrible violent action, and we feel terrible about that. In an aid in dying, we feel sad that the person is gone, but they're no longer suffering, and there's a relief there. And so the grief reaction is normal in aid in dying, and it's totally abnormal in a suicidal case. So I think the language is very, very important.
Something I've always wondered about, David, is when someone chooses to die using this medically prescribed means, how does it affect, say, the cause of death that's listed on their death certificate? How does it affect something like life insurance? Does that vary from state to state, or do we have uniform rules, especially considering many insurance companies are national?
The rules are uniform in all cases. It does not impact life insurance. If a person who's aid in dying does not have any restrictions or any lose any contracts or contractual benefits. The death certificate is the terminal illness is written, and I'll kind of give you an example. Let's say a patient has lung cancer. They've been through all the treatments, surgery, radiation. It's not working. They're about to die. They use aid in dying medication. We write on the death certificate lung cancer. We don't write a medical aid in dying. And there's really no difference, if you will, think about this, between that and someone who's in the ICU and has a breathing tube removed because they're brain dead. They are going to immediately die from the doctor taking out the breathing tube, but we don't put that on the death certificate. We say brain death from motor vehicle accident. So the death certificate has two parts to it. It has some to determine the estate of the individual, and the epidemiological data. All the epidemiological data will be available for the Department of Health through the forms that the doctor completes.
That was Dr. David Grube of the nonprofit organization Compassionate Choices speaking with HBR's Ryan Finnerty. Hawaii's medical aid in dying law took effect on January 1st. Iolani Palace was all decked out for evening tours this past weekend. It was to honor Queen Kapi'olani's birthday, which fell on New Year's Eve. We went on a night tour of the palace and talked to authors of a new book about palace history, Carol Maxim and McKinnon Simpson. Now, along the way, we were treated to hula in the throne room, but we start off with chamber music in the blue room. Thank you.
It's about the Iolani Palace, which has a much longer history than many people who come see it casually would think, because Iolani Palace actually is built on sacred land that was where palace was before. So it's a long history of palace, to the palace we know, to when it became the executive building, to when it was the center for military operations during World War II, back to the executive building, state capitol, and finally museum. So that's why we call it a metaphor for two centuries of Hawaii history. Learning about the palace kind of takes you right through 200 years of Hawaii history.
Well, I was struck by the fact that the entire World War II operation was run out of here. It had been the civilian government, and then when martial law went into effect, it became the military government, and they ran everything from Iolani Palace. And they swore in the 442nd, all those guys here, and just basically ran the entire territory from this building. So at the very end, when the state built the new capital, there was a question of whether they were going to knock it down, make condos or a shopping mall, whatever. And luckily, we ended up with a museum.
It was really the ladies of the Junior League who came forward and put their time, effort, and money into it, and did enormous amounts of research about the palace and life at the time of the monarchy, so that then it was decided to turn it into a museum, funds were raised, and here we are today. Of course, you saw the main beautiful Koa staircase. There we have a photo where there's a piece of it that was ripped out for a drinking fountain. And in the restoration, the drinking fountain went and the Koa came back.
So it's kind of restored in all her glory.
It is beautifully, beautifully, thoughtfully, artistically restored and kept up meticulously. There's one photo in there that really nobody gets to see the likes of. It's the doors between the blue room and the dining room closed, and nobody ever sees that because they're always kept open for tours. Those doors are some of the most beautiful woodwork you will ever see, and we have photo in there with those doors closed.
And even the curators had never seen them until we had a hurricane alert this past fall, and the security guards came and closed all the doors. They're just stunned with the spectacular woodworking, because they'd always been open. They were pocket doors, and they'd always been slid back.
Well, I had always worried about Iolani Palace. If we had a super hurricane here, what would happen?
Well, speak with the curators, because they moved everything into the center. We actually were scheduled to have our photo shoot the day that Hurricane Lane fortunately didn't arrive, but was supposed to, but they had moved everything to preserve it. And that's when they saw the doors. So when we came back a couple weeks later, they mentioned, and so we closed the doors and took the photo so people could see.
Really appreciate something that was really in plain sight, but couldn't be appreciated because they stayed open.
Correct.
And there are a number of photos that we had Rick Noyle, photographer, take of areas that the tour does not include, just because they can't, you know, they're small rooms, and so they just basically rope them off. So there's a lot in here that otherwise is not seen, even by somebody who just took the tour.
Today, one of our major medical centers carries her name, Kapi'olani Medical Center.
It evokes a time, the glories of the palace, of the monarchy, and I'm not making a political statement when I say that. I'm making a statement about the beauty of the time and the beauty of what was surrounding the people.
Talking to the authors of a new book, Metaphors of Two Centuries, documenting the Iolani Palace history. We took part in an evening tour over the holidays in a nod to the monarchy and the long palace history.
Hello, I'm Bill Comerford, president of Kelly O'Neill's in O'Toole's Irish Pub. There's a certain pride in knowing that you know, you're providing something cultural for the community, particularly when it matches what we do. That's just like heaven. You know, it's appropriate to us and it's appropriate to the cultural aspect of the whole islands, and it's appropriate to what we do in our bars. It's just a natural fit. I'm very happy to have it.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
That's it for this week. Coming up next week, we throw the spotlight on pedestrian safety on a call-in show. The fatality rate for 2018 was terribly high, and we'd like to start the year off right, keeping everyone safe. We'd like to hear from you, have a story to share, a gripe about others on the road and the sidewalks, or you can call our talkback line and leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. This program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Congrusby. The backyard theme written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday and pick up The Conversation.